From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Sissela Bach was born in Sweden, the eyes of the country were on her and her family. Her parents were Nobel Prize winners Alva and Gunnar Myrdal, famous for their controversial views on contraception, sex education, and family planning. On today's Fresh Air, we talk to Bach. Her memoir about her mother is just out in paperback. Also, the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association is holding its first conference in San Francisco. We'll meet the group's founder, Roy Ahrens. He says he spent much of his own career leading a double life. And book critic John Leonard reviews Alice Walker's new novel, Possessing the Secret of Joy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A House Transportation Committee has approved legislation that would bring the nationwide rail shutdown to an end by tomorrow. The measure would require rail companies to resume operations and force union workers back to work during a 38-day cooling-off period. If the railroads and the unions fail to reach agreement on their own, the legislation would impose binding arbitration. The full House is expected to begin debate on the measure within about an hour. House and Senate leaders have said they'll bring the bill to a vote and have it on the president's desk before midnight. Unless Congress acts tonight to approve legislation ending the rail slowdown, some 2,300 workers at a General Motors assembly plant in Indiana may be forced to stay home tomorrow because of part shortages. Dan Dreyer of member station WBNI in Fort Wayne, Indiana, reports.
General Motors officials in Fort Wayne will make a decision later tonight whether to tell its second shift employees to remain home tomorrow. This morning, officials at the Fort Wayne assembly plant told 1,000 first shift workers not to report for work until Monday. Company spokesman Jerry King says the plant will operate a short second shift and may shut down if the rail strike isn't settled by 7:30. King cannot say how much money the plant is losing during the shutdown. Trains ship 60% of the more than 800 full-size pickup trucks produced each day. General Motors has said it may divert some of its rail shipments to trucks, but the company says this would be a short-term solution. For National Public Radio, I'm Dan Dreyer in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
A conference intended to foster greater economic cooperation among former Soviet republics and Eastern Bloc nations bordering the Black Sea has instead become focused on ending the crisis in Moldova. The leaders of Russia, Moldova, Ukraine, and Romania are taking part in the meeting. Hal Jones reports from the meeting in Istanbul.
Their collective call for a ceasefire, a separation of fighting groups, and the setting up of security zones to facilitate humanitarian aid was not unexpected. However, progress in those areas will depend largely on progress towards settling two key issues: the status of the Dniester region, whose mainly Russian inhabitants fear the rest of Moldova will one day unite with Romania, and the status of the Russian army in Moldova while the future of the Dniester region is being decided. The four presidents admitted they probably won't be able to solve the problem themselves. They appeal to the CSCE, the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, to help with mediation, and they said they would welcome a more active peacemaking role by the United Nations, which has already agreed to send a fact-finding mission to the area in the near future. For National Public Radio, this is Hal Jones in Istanbul.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 7 points to close at 3,284. Advances edged declines in active trading. This is NPR. A House committee voted today to strip funding from the White House Council on Competitiveness, headed by Vice President Dan Quayle. Critics charge that the council provides business with a way to exert secret influence on government and bypass Congress to get rid of regulations it doesn't like. Quayle says the council is committed to eliminating excessive, burdensome, and unnecessary regulations that threaten American jobs. The vice president's press secretary charged that the House Appropriations Committee was knuckling under to special interest groups. The astronauts aboard the space shuttle Columbia have gotten down to work today. The crew blasted into space early this afternoon following a brief weather delay. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
The power has been switched on inside the first U.S. microgravity laboratory, located within the cargo bay of the Space Shuttle Columbia. It is there that the five men and two women crew will spend the next 13 days in orbit. Shuttle Deputy Director and former astronaut Brewster Shaw says it's time to find out whether those kids are really friends or not. The laboratory is 23 feet long, about the size of a house trailer. The 31 onboard experiments, which will concentrate on biotechnology and other life sciences, will actually take a back seat to the endurance record the crew will set. Scientists with the space station program will be curious to see how each crew member is affected during their extended time in space. Commander Dick Richards must keep his wits about him in order to pilot the shuttle back to Earth. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The head of the Public Health Service said today that violence, accidents, and AIDS have joined heart disease and cancer as leading causes of death, especially among young Americans. Dr. James Mason noted that heart disease and stroke deaths are down to unprecedented levels, but he said that younger Americans are dying more often of injury, violence, and AIDS. Mason said that homicide is now the second largest cause of death among people between the ages of 15 and 24. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cicely Bach is best known for her books on the ethics of lying and keeping secrets. But her latest book is more personal. It's a memoir about her mother, and it's now out in paperback. Bach is the daughter of Gunnar and Alva Myrdal, the only husband and wife team to each win a Nobel Prize in different fields. He won for economics. She won the Peace Prize for her work on disarmament. Many of the dilemmas women are facing today, Alva Myrdal faced and wrote about in the 40s and 50s. She had a career of international scope while raising three children. Myrdal was one of the architects of Sweden's family and social policies. She was Sweden's ambassador to India and head of the UN's Department of Social Affairs. Her responsibilities often took her away from her family. Cicely Bach was born in December of 1934, just about a month after the publication of her parents' controversial book, Crisis in the Population Question. The book put her parents at the center of national debates about families, contraception, and child care. And all of Sweden seemed to be interested in how the Myrdals would bring up their own children. Cicely's birth was covered in the Stockholm newspapers.
They regarded it as something of a scandal because the book was something of a scandal. Here was a woman who was actually signing her name to a book that talked about sexuality, about family planning, contraceptives, all kinds of things that in those days, Puritan Sweden did not think women should be talking about at all, preferably not men either.
Do you think your mother was self-conscious about how she brought you up, knowing that she was in the public eye?
I think she cared a lot about bringing up children, but I don't think the fact that she was in the public eye altered how she was doing it. She had established a school for training nursery school teachers, and she cared a great deal about how one might raise children to be happier individuals, and in particular how one might raise girls not to develop all the feelings of incompetence and weakness that she saw so many girls having, and of course she herself had been brought up to think that she couldn't do all kinds of things because she was a girl and she shouldn't really try to do them.
Did she do things differently with you than other mothers of the time did with their daughters so that you wouldn't feel inferior by virtue of being a woman?
It certainly seemed that way, both to my sister and to myself. We had a sense that our upbringing was just much freer in many ways. And we knew that other people looked at us, in fact, as rather badly brought up because we didn't really always act just the way little girls were supposed to act. We didn't seem to care enough about dolls and we didn't seem to care enough about pretty clothes, for instance. So we did know that there was a difference, but we always thought that we were very well off in that sense.
Your mother became a writer and a thinker at a time when there were very few women who were doing that and also having families. And she was really way ahead of her time in having to figure out how to have both a career and a family. And you write about how all the women who she knew of who were scholars never married and never had children. So they didn't have to make those kinds of choices.
Right. I mean, those were the women that she did admire for having done something with their lives. But on the whole, they had no children, even if they had been married, and most of them definitely had not married either, and she just knew that she wanted to have a different kind of life. She really did want to have a family very much. She did want to have children, but she had absolutely no models that she could think of for women who had done both and done so creatively. And in her own family, her mother in particular, was very afraid of sexuality and afraid of having children, in part because her mother had died in childbirth at the age of 31. And so my mother's mother, terrified in this way, actually had 5 children, but was very resistant to the whole idea and spent a lot of time, especially later in her life, in bed, partly so as to avoid her husband and all kinds of family responsibilities. And my mother was just sure that she didn't want to lead her life that way. But that's where family planning came in again, and contraception. She didn't want to be in the situation where she might end up having innumerable children. She wanted to be able to have a life in which she could decide when the children would fit in and how that would work with being employed. But of course, then she found out that however carefully you plan, there are many, many complications about trying to do both.
Well, early on in her life as a mother, she made a decision that I think she was always unsure about, that she always in some ways regretted. This was before you were born, but your mother's first son, Jan, or is it Jan?
Jan,
thank
yes.
you. Mm-hmm. He was 2 years old when your mother had the opportunity to go with your father to New York. For research?
Yes.
And she decided to go and to leave her son at his grandparents' house in the country, thinking that that would really be good. But what was the problem?
Well, the problem was that obviously it cut her links in many ways with this little boy, and she knew in her heart of hearts that she shouldn't perhaps have left him. On the other hand, she was dying to go to America. She and my father had both been offered fellowships to study in this country, and that was very unusual at the time. She was 27 years old, and she was terribly torn, and my father insisted that she come without the little boy. And nowadays, I think it would have been much easier to think through the problem and to think of all we know now about that 2-year-old stage when children really need to bond in a way with their parents. And I think most of us would not make the same choice. But she was very torn. She later thought it had been a terrible mistake, but she did it at the time. And once she came to America, she loved her opportunity to study and do research.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Sissela Bach, and she's the author of books about the ethics of lying and keeping secrets. But her new book is a memoir about her mother, Alva Myrdal, the Swedish writer, diplomat, and Nobel Peace Prize winner. I think our view of relationships is often framed by watching our parents and by watching the kind of conflicts they have with each other. Now, your mother watched her parents' battles about the conflict between sexuality and having more children. Your mother didn't want to, your grandmother didn't want to just keep having more children, and she was very wary of having sex because of that. What were the battles between your parents that you watched and that helped frame your idea of relationships?
Well, one, and perhaps the most important, probably had to do with how one relates to one's children. I could see that there was my mother struggling so hard both to have close relationships and indeed friendships with her children, and on the other hand also help and be close to this man who demanded fantastic amounts of attention, and that was my father. And he was in many ways, she always thought, a genius, and a genius required very special kinds of help. He was temperamental, he could be depressed, he could be elated. She knew how much she could help him, and she knew that he essentially wanted her all to himself, and he did not want her to spend very much time at all with the children. In fact, though he was a feminist, and I think that's very important for me to stress, he always supported her work, and he always supported other women who wanted to do things. But at the same time, he did not think that they should have children. He thought that a bright, talented woman should dedicate herself totally to her work, and if there was a husband, also to the husband, but not particularly to the children. And seeing that, I just knew that I could never lead that kind of life. I'd rather not marry at all than marry someone who demanded that kind of divorce from my children, from me. And, of course, she didn't carry it out either. She really tried to do everything. She didn't succeed always, but I think she did pretty well.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sissela Bach, and she's best known for her books about the ethics of lying and keeping secrets. Her new book is a memoir about her mother, Alva Myrdal, the Swedish writer, diplomat, and Nobel Peace Prize winner. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Sissela Bach is my guest. Her new book is called Alva Myrdal, A Daughter's Memoir. Your mother wrote that children should feel free and strong and able to resist their parents. How did she feel when you rebelled against her?
I think that that, again, produced a little bit of a surprise for her, not one that made her angry. And in a way, we never rebelled in such a way as to want to make her angry. We went our own way, and I think she was very supportive of that because she specifically argued all the way through, her youth and the years when she was talking about child psychology. She especially argued against the idea that children should be brought up to obey adults no matter what. So I think she was pleased in that sense. At the same time, she obviously thought sometimes that we could have gone in slightly different directions, and then she would always toss out thousands of ideas toward us, ideas about what to study, how to live, how to furnish whatever place we were living in. And that, in turn, was something that we appreciated enormously, I think. She never tried to force us, but she had all these ideas. In particular, I remember one time I talk about a young man that I had actually gotten engaged to at age 17. I now look back at that with some trepidation. At that time, instead of saying anything about the fact that I might be too young or that he might not be the right husband for me forever and ever, she took me instead on one of her trips to England, and we visited Oxford and Cambridge universities, and I ran into a lot of other young men, and I began to put my situation in perspective. But she never, never forced even that situation.
What were the things that you rebelled about in your relationship with your mother?
There was a time, especially in adolescence, when I felt that her brand of competence and being so sensible and knowing so much seemed to shut out what I thought was very important about emotions and poetry and light and darkness and secrets, as I wrote. It didn't seem to me that she spent enough time at all in the almost magical garden where we lived in Geneva. And I just had a kind of dream life that I didn't think she shared. So I wrote in my diary at one point that I never wanted to share her values. As I now look back at that, I realize that I didn't really see her fully at that time, 15, 16, 17. But on the other hand, I think I had to go through that phase before understanding her more fully.
How did your relationship with your mother change when you became an adult?
Well, what happened was I was living in Paris with her when I was 18 and 19. And as I say, I was in this rather sulky mood, but so many things were happening in Paris at the time. The French were winding down their brutal war in Vietnam. There were street battles in which I saw people, Vietnamese and others, bleeding. There were all kinds of marvelous singers like Juliette Gréco. So many things were happening in Paris that I began to think I needed to talk with her about it in spite of my resistance. And then I met, when I was 19, I met Derek Bach, who would then shortly become my husband. And again, I had a sense that now I wanted to share something with her. This was something so extraordinary. And perhaps, after all, I had to grow up. And if I were to grow up, I knew that I would have to have a different kind of relationship with her. Even then, however, I was a bit tentative, and it wasn't until after I had married, and in fact moved to America, and she had gone to India, that my husband asked me how it could be that I was still on a somewhat tentative relationship with her. And then I wrote her a letter where essentially I asked her to forgive me for not having understood her enough. And I think that was an enormous turning point in my relationship with her.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sisala Bach, and her new book is a memoir about her mother, Alva Murdaugh. Your parents, before they died, drew up a will that willed all of their money to a foundation for artists and writers. And as you write in your book, they didn't believe in inherited wealth. I wonder how you felt about that, and how you felt, too, knowing that that money wouldn't go to your grandchildren. I mean, to your children, to your parents' grandchildren.
Yes, at the time, I must say, when I heard about this, my father wrote me, and it seemed to me that my parents had every right to do what they wanted. They were not in any sense millionaires, and they had every right to do with the money that they had earned, having started out with nothing in their own lives, or very little. So at the time, that seemed perfectly reasonable, and they had always been enormously generous, and continued to be so, in fact, with all the grandchildren. So there was no sense at the time that there was a problem. And most of all, I think, like most people probably, I did not want to think about such things as their passing away and their having a will. It was later that the problem arose, when it turned out that this foundation, called a Universal Heir, as I recall, also had received all the photo albums, all the books, all the mementos, and that, we felt, was really a problem because we wanted to save some of those for ourselves and very much for the children. So then we had to go and ask permission of the Universal Heir, who graciously allowed us to go into the storage vault and select things for our children and take away the photo albums and other mementos. And that was problematic, and in a sense that made me realize that I wasn't going to do things quite that way myself.
Your parents both lived into their early 80s, and you write that in the 1980s there were several magazines that did feature articles about your parents, and that these articles created false pictures of your parents' bliss together in their latter years.
Yes, at the time, by that time, my parents had obviously, you know, they'd had many separations, they'd gone through all kinds of ups and downs. They were very supportive to one another in so many ways, but my mother had also had to carve out an existence of her own. So when all these magazine interviews came around and all these headlines suggesting that here was this couple and they were so blissfully happy and they just loved every moment together, my mother felt that that was a false image that was being projected. My father always was very willing to, I mean, he half believed it all, so he was very willing to make it sound that way. And my mother could not at that point very well say, wait a little, to the interviewer, wait a little, by the way, we have our problems too. That didn't seem to fit with her idea of the diplomatic person that she was. So there was a sense of a false mask. And part of what I'm doing in the book, really, is to do what I think she wanted, namely to show that underneath that mask, there was this living, breathing human being who, in fact, you know, was not just part of the perfect couple or the totally accomplished woman who had it all, but an actual human being who had many ideals, many problems, many tensions, and who managed to work many of them out.
Well, speaking of removing the mask, your older brother had written a memoir about your parents that was very negative. I haven't read it. You know, I've just read what you've said about it. But, you know, your mother and father left your older brother for a year, left him with his grandparents when he was two so that they could do research in New York. And I don't know if that contributed to his feelings toward them or not, but I wonder what effect it had on the family to have a memoir that put them into a pretty bad light as parents.
That was a very, very sad time in their lives. My brother had already broken with them in 1967 when my mother was 65, and explained that he really couldn't take any more the tensions, especially with my father and my father's way of very aggressively sometimes teasing him. And my brother had just decided that he had had enough of that. So they were not seeing one another. But I don't think my parents had expected that he would publish this book, which he called Childhood, where he essentially says that not only was there a problem with my father, by the way, it's a novel, but it uses their names.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
Yes. Not only was there this problem with my father, but my mother had been a cold and most unpleasant, most unmotherly parent. My mother learned about that book in the fall of 1982, and it actually appeared just during the same weeks when she found out that she had received the Nobel Prize for Peace. She was 80 years old then, and there she was with her highest ambition in life almost, named having to do with peace, being recognized in this way on the one hand, and on the other hand, her highest ambition in her private life having to do with the family, and when those two seemed to clash so completely. And it was shattering for her. It was very, very hard, and I do talk about that.
Did you ever talk to your brother about it?
I did. I tried many times to have a reconciliation between my brother and my parents. It never worked. And I think both my brother and I have come to the conclusion, after thinking through our various respective books, that we did have very different childhoods. I came along 7.5 years later, and I did not experience what he experienced, and I can't know what he experienced. So in a way, in the book also, I try to be careful not to say what I think about his childhood, but rather to quote him and to quote the various headlines about his book that had quite a devastating effect on my parents.
Why did you want to write this book about your mother?
I wanted to write it in part because of those events that had made her feel that she was not understood in the right way. Most people in Sweden at the time thought she was almost a saint, this woman who has won all these prizes and who does everything so well and who has this perfect marriage and who can do it all. Then there were some people who were very critical. My brother was one, and the headlines made her seem almost like a half-demon. And then there were other people who thought that she was a cold, calculating social engineer. Nothing seemed to fit. And she began to think what she had never thought before, namely that she should write her own memoirs. And just then, she, however, was developing a form of aphasia, of not being able to speak properly and not being able to write properly. So that just when she was getting ready in a way to write her memoirs, she became unable to do so. And she told me in 1984, in the summer of 1984 when I was visiting, that she worried about this, and she said, "What happens if I can't explain anything anymore?" And that's the sentence that my book begins with, and that's the sentence that really set me thinking, maybe there's something I can do about helping in this explaining process. I know I can't do it as she might have, but I might just try anyway. And that's how I started what I think of now as a dialogue, really, but a dialogue with a person who could no longer speak. So it had to be with her letters, her writings, her diary materials that she had given to me, and everything else that I could lay my hands on.
Sissel Abak, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Sissel Abak's memoir about her mother, Alva Myrdal, is now out in paperback. We spoke last year when it was published in hardcover. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association is holding their first annual conference in San Francisco. Coming up, we'll meet the group's founder, Roy Ahrens. He says the newsroom can be a homophobic place, affecting how gay reporters are treated and how gay issues are covered. Ahrens is the former executive editor of the Oakland Tribune and former West Coast and New York correspondent for the Washington Post. Also, John Leonard reviews Alice Walker's new novel, Possessing the Secret of Joy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A nationwide rail shutdown moved into its second day today, with virtually all freight service and some passenger service at a standstill. Congress moved closer this evening to approving a measure that would get the trains rolling again. NPR's Eric Weiner reports from Capitol Hill.
The House Energy and Commerce Committee approved the bill by a vote of 37-5. Under the plan, there would be a 20-day cooling-off period, followed by 15 days of binding arbitration. The plan would end the shutdown, get the trains rolling again, and yet not put Congress in the position of choosing sides. House Democrats, in particular, are concerned about alienating labor by imposing a contract that might be viewed as favoring management. Congress is expected to vote on the back-to-work bill later this evening, and after President Bush's signature, the trains could be rolling again by tomorrow. At the Capitol, I'm Eric Weiner.
Iran-Contra independent counsel Lawrence Walsh has filed an interim report with Congress saying that he expects to end his investigation by the end of this summer, but has yet to decide whether or not to seek indictments against other high-ranking officials in the Reagan or Bush administrations. Walsh said in his report that he is now seeking to determine whether officials at the highest levels of government sought to obstruct official investigations into the Iran-Contra affair. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Walsh said that his investigation has continued for so long, 5.5 years, in fact, because it is only in the last 2 years that his office has discovered information that was previously withheld, information in the form of notes taken by high officials, CIA cables and tapes, and other records. All of this material, said Walsh, had for years been withheld from his investigators and had only been turned over after he renewed document requests made originally in 1987 to the White House, the office of then-Vice President Bush, and to various other agencies dealing with national security. When the material was finally turned over, said Walsh, it provided new and disturbing evidence not previously available, evidence that required witnesses to be re-interviewed. This, said Walsh, was not merely a cleanup chore. It has provided, he said, a significant shift in our understanding of which administration officials had knowledge of Iran-Contra, who participated in its cover-up, and which areas required far more scrutiny than we previously believed. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The Labor Department says that first-time claims for unemployment benefits were up in the latest reporting week. The government says that claims in the week ending June 13th were up to 422,000, or 16,000 more than the week before. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 7 points in very active trading. This is NPR News. In Berlin, the German parliament has voted to ease abortion laws for women in Western Germany and give them the same liberalized rights as East German women. The vote was 356-282 to allow women in the first 3 months of pregnancy to decide for themselves whether to have an abortion. It adds the stipulation that a pregnant woman must seek counseling at least 3 days before an abortion. Earlier, Parliament threw out a proposal supported by German Chancellor Kohl to make West Germany's more restrictive abortion rule the law for a unified Germany. According to a report by the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, mammogram screening for breast cancer can significantly lower death rates in older women. Rick McCourt reports.
The CDC reports on five large studies in the United States, Sweden, and Scotland involving 343,000 women who were invited to participate in a mammography screening program. The study showed that women aged 50 to 69 who had mammograms lowered their chance of dying from breast cancer by as much as 39%. Mammograms are X-ray pictures of the breast that can detect tumors as small as a rice grain at a stage when cancers are more treatable. The CDC report also notes that the incidence of breast cancer has gone up by more than 25% in the last decade. 100,000 U.S. women will develop breast cancer this year, and 46,000 women will die of the disease. These numbers are expected to increase as the population of American women ages. The CDC and American Cancer Society recommend that women over 50 have a mammogram and clinical examination by a physician every year. For National Public Radio, this is Rick McCourt in Washington.
2 days after a Labor Party victory in Israel, Defense Minister Aaron says that he is getting out of public life. This move takes him out of competition for party leader when Prime Minister Shamir steps down. Aaron says when a new Israeli government is chosen, then he will leave politics. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association opens its first national conference tonight in San Francisco. The sessions will address how the mainstream press covers gay issues and the problems gay journalists often face in the newsroom. My guest is the founder of the group, Roy Ahrens. He's the former executive editor of the Oakland Tribune and the former West Coast and New York correspondent for the Washington Post. Tomorrow morning, the conference will present a video message from the new publisher of the New York Times, Arthur Sulzberger Jr. Ahrens says Sulzberger's participation is a sign of how the New York Times has changed.
The New York Times has undergone what almost amounts to a revolution in the last several years, and particularly now with the young Sulzberger taking over as the publisher. I have a text of his video address that is going to be given tomorrow, and it's really, it's astonishing. I could give a couple of quotes from it that I think are very interesting.
Sure, go ahead.
"We need to find the courage to cover the world the way it is. We must offer our readers coverage of the broad gay community, its people, and its issues. While coverage of the AIDS epidemic is crucial, we must move beyond the shroud of AIDS in our writing about gays. Lesbians are almost invisible in news coverage. Only through responsible coverage of your world, coverage that goes beyond sexuality and disease, will we begin to overcome the fear that too many straight people have about gays and lesbians." He also acknowledges that for many years, gays and lesbians at the Times lived in fear. And he says that we must assure that all gays and lesbians at the Times have the same degree of freedom and privilege as do straight people, and that includes health insurance and other benefits for partners. So he's making a little news there.
Mm-hmm. Why did you think that a National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association was needed?
Well, I started from a kind of neutral place here. I was very busy as executive editor of the Oakland Tribune, trying to run a newspaper, when the American Society of Newspaper Editors asked me to coordinate a landmark survey, the first time they'd ever attempted to do this, about gays and lesbians working in the newspaper industry. I guess the reason I was asked is that besides being a ranking editor, I was also out, at least in my own news operation. And they needed to have somebody who could locate gay journalists who'd be willing to participate in the survey. So I set up a team, and we began to do that, I think rather successfully. And we did it by telephone calls, by word of mouth, by posting flyers in newsrooms. And I began to develop, for the first time in my life, a network of personal contact with gay and lesbian journalists on newspapers all over the country. And among other things, what I began to hear was a desire to connect. I called one journalist at the Providence newspaper who had heard about this, called me and was terribly excited about it, as were most of the journalists. And then he said, "Do you know anybody else at my newspaper?" And I said, "Yeah, I do, but I can't tell you because of this whole confidentiality thing." And he said, "God, is there some way that we can begin to link up and connect?" So that planted the idea in my mind. Then I delivered the results of the survey, which showed fairly predictably that there was homophobia in the newsrooms, that gay journalists perceived their own institutions doing a mediocre job in general on coverage, and that they had a sense of isolation and living in the shadows. when I delivered the results of that survey to the gathered editors, my editor peers in Washington in 1990, I had to make a decision. Do I come out publicly, nationally, or do I not? And in retrospect, I made a decision to say, yes, I'm a gay man and an editor, and I'm proud of ASNE for accomplishing this.
ASNE is the American Society of Newspaper Editors, who commissioned the study.
Yes. And that made me even more of a kind of a magnet for letters and phone calls and people saying, let's do something about this. We need to talk to one another. And that was the genesis.
Mm-hmm.
Very short time ago, actually, less than a year and a half, when we, a few of us, five or six of us, got together in my dining room and created the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association. We thought we were being pretty presumptuous at the time, but the growth has been amazing.
Are there people who are reluctant to join because joining might bring them a step closer to being out? I mean, your name's on a mailing list. You're getting mailings with the return address saying National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association.
We're very careful to protect confidentiality. The return mailing, Frank says NLGJA rather than spelling it out. We're trying to be very, very cautious. We've grown rapidly to 500 paid members and a mailing list of about 700 to 800. Now, that's only a fraction of the gay and lesbian journalists working in the industry. I have to assume that in addition to people who still don't know about it, there are a lot of people who are still afraid to join.
Do you think that there are any unique problems that a journalist has in coming out?
Yes, there are. One is there are possible career implications. Secondly, there is the question of perception. They face the possibility that they may be seen as representing some kind of a special interest. And they struggle with this issue, the advocacy versus the objectivity. And it's a new experience because while Afro-American journalists banded together in associations 15, 17 years ago, Hispanics and the rest, gays and lesbians are just experimenting with this. I think what they're beginning to learn is that they need to make the argument that they insist upon being seen as professionals who've been in this business for years and years, doing competent, excellent jobs with high professional journalistic standards. That does not end just because you come out and be totally who you are.
My guest is journalist Roy Ahrens. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Roy Ahrens, founder of the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association. You decided to come out nationally when you were giving the results of the survey that you were commissioned to do. Was that a hard choice?
It was a difficult choice. I had come out in 83 at my own newspaper in the Tribune when I came on to my first job there. That was a tough move as well, because I've been in journalism for 34 years now, and 24 of them I lived as a closeted person and a closeted professional, living in fear that someone would spot me going into a bar and that it would have some impact on a kind of personal rejection or perhaps some career implications. In making that decision before hundreds of peer editor colleagues, the night before I was to deliver the findings, the text of my statement did not have my coming out statement in it. I woke up the next morning and began to think, here I am talking about other gay and lesbian journalists living in the shadows, and I'm going. I just can't walk up there and pretend that I am something that I'm not. So I added the words that I described before at the end, and interestingly, there was a subtext that kind of echoed internally for me, reflexively, which was, "Here I am, world, all of me at last." So I have to tell you that these are not easy decisions, both in terms of professional issues and in terms of personal issues.
You know, I'm thinking coming out when you did might have been really different experience for you than for instance, a young reporter, because you're more advanced in your career. You're kind of in the establishment. You were in the establishment part of the press as an editor of a paper, not a reporter slowly, you know, on the rise. You know what I'm saying?
You're absolutely right. Yeah, I felt pretty safe about it, actually. I was living in California, in Northern California. I was nurtured and sheltered by my boss, my newspaper. And as a matter of fact, I got very, very little negative reaction. One of my concerns in doing that was I'm the editor of the paper, you know. I'm a policymaker. Is it going to change the way in which I'm perceived and the way in which the paper is perceived? And I was very pleasantly surprised to see that the public reaction was not negative. I think it is more difficult for young reporters, and they've asked me, you know, students coming out of college, thinking of trying to get into the profession, they want to know: do I put something on my resume that I'm gay or I belong to gay organizations? Do I put a code word out there so people will know, or do I not? And I said, you know, it has to be an individual decision. It depends, you know, what environment you're entering, what city, what area, and you know, when to come out has got to be everybody's individual decision. I think that one of the things that our organization does not do is to try to apply inordinate pressure to influence anybody to make that step.
Mm-hmm. What led you to come out in 83 at the Tribune, where you were an editor, before you came out beyond that?
Yes. Moving to California, moving into a new job, I had become involved in a very happy one-on-one relationship with a spouse a couple of years before that. I had gone through a personal transformation where I had dealt with much of the self-esteem and self-hatred and the internalized homophobia issues that most gays have to go through. And I just felt that that I could not start this new life, this new job, and continue to do the kind of thing that I had done before. So shortly after I came to the newspaper, I held a cocktail reception at my home, and standing at the door beside me was Joshua, and it was quite obvious to everybody, and that was the end of it.
I'm interested in your critique of press coverage of gay issues as a journalist yourself. Let's start with language. I mean, I was reading a few press clips in which you were mentioned, and one of them said, Aaron's an acknowledged gay. Do you like that kind of an acknowledged term? You know, an acknowledged homosexual, an acknowledged gay.
Yeah, no, I don't particularly like it. It's like an acknowledged felon. there's a lot of those kinds of terms that I think we have some work to do on. Whenever anybody's involved in a love affair, it's called a homosexual love affair. We don't talk about heterosexual love affairs. And if it's obvious in the context of the statement, there's no necessity for that. So I think there is a certain sensitivity. We try to stay away from overstressing political correctness in terminology, but I think that just as editors have become educated and had their consciousness raised about what feels good to other ethnic minorities and to women, it should not be difficult to make that transition, I think, in the press, and that's one of the things we work on.
I'm wondering if in this group that you created, if you feel that there are a lot of journalists who are much more radical in their approach to gay issues and gay rights than you are, and if so, how you feel about that, if that makes you uncomfortable or not.
Well, I guess that there probably are journalists in our group who would view me as being someone on the conservative side of the spectrum. And we've had discussions constantly within our organization, and I think these are legitimate discussions as to, you know, how do you serve your role as a member of your journalistic craft and at the same time deal with your responsibility to these issues. I have to say that I probably started out a lot more conservative than I am now in building the organization with the many colleagues who have helped to do this, work together with them, and in exposing myself to a lot of information and a lot of study and examination that I hadn't before. I think that it's moved me a little bit toward the left and perhaps some of my colleagues a little bit more toward the center.
What issues do you feel you've moved on?
Well, I think that I've begun to get a broader perspective on the role of a gay journalist in the press. I think that, you know, to hide behind the notion of objectivity in the face of injustice seems to me to be just that, to be hiding. I think that one of the traditions of journalism is to fight injustice, to work in behalf of the underdog. And I guess the other thing that's been happening to me is the more I read about and experience and watch the effort to force gays back into the closet, the fact that homosexuality is one of the last places where scapegoating is considered permissible, I start to feel some passion about this that may have been suppressed before, to be perfectly honest with you.
Sunday is the Gay Pride Parade, and you're based in San Francisco. Are you the parade type? Will you be marching?
I will be marching in the parade behind the NLGJA banner. This will be the first time in my life I've ever marched in the parade.
So that I guess that'll be a significant experience for you.
I knew you were going to say that. It's going to be a big moment for me. I've come to the conclusion in my own mind that the time is right to do that. The Gay Pride Parade really has become a cultural celebration, and it's just what it is. It's pride, and it's a statement of identity, and I have no problem with that. In fact, I look forward to it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was very enjoyable. I appreciate it.
Roy Ahrens is the founder of the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association. Their first national conference opens tonight in San Francisco. This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Noah Adams and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. We'll check in on the rail strike to assess the effects on shipping and travel around the country. Tom Jelton reports from Sarajevo in Bosnia about the fighting there. Alan Siporin on an anti-gay rights law in a town in Oregon. We'll review the career of Yitzhak Rabin, soon to be Israel's prime minister, as leader of the Labor Party. And we'll talk with a writer at Outside Magazine about a new compilation of the best places to live in America. 10 places, he says, that have it all. Traverse City, Michigan is on the list, Cornwall, New York, Portland, Oregon, and sorry to say, not Washington, D.C., and not Philadelphia.
Okay, well, thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Alice Walker says that she wrote her new novel, Possessing the Secret of Joy, as a duty to her conscience as an African-American woman. Her 1982 novel, The Color Purple, won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Walker's new book, Possessing the Secret of Joy.
Alice Walker always has her own agenda, and sometimes this agenda isn't mine, and so I get tired of her bullying. Moreover, in the service of any of her many causes, she is also inclined to bully her characters. Except in my favorite among her books, Meridian, her novel about the civil rights movement, she seems to have preordained the behavior of these characters. They will do what she tells them to, or they're out of the picture. After her last novel, The Temple of My Familiar, I decided she wasn't writing for me. And that's all right. Lots of writers don't. Nobody makes me read them. I say all this as preamble, because I sat down to Possessing the Secret of Joy, suspicious and defensive. I had my immediate doubts about a novel dedicated to the blameless vulva. I found myself resisting for almost 50 pages this story about female circumcision. No, female circumcision is too kind a term. Genital mutilation is what happens to Tashi. And I read on, horrified and spellbound. It seems to me now, in a kind of daze, that possessing the secret of joy can only be described as a Holocaust novel. These things actually happen. They are beyond comprehension. To make art about them is a kind of insult. And yet art may be the only way we can get from mourning to healing, as if beauty itself were the ultimate revenge on the monstrous. You may remember Tashi, or Evelyn, the name she took when she married Adam, the American missionary to the African Olinka. Tashi made brief appearances in The Color Purple in the Temple of My Familiar. Possessing the Secret of Joy is an account of everything that happened to her before, during, and after those novels. And clitorectomy is, if not the least of it, nevertheless just a single item in a long list of physical and psychological depredations. And yet nothing about this Tashi is preordained. As she discovers herself, she is a continuing surprise. And this discovery is a splendid exploration on three continents into memory and history and myth. Not only are African rituals and Dogon creation myths evoked, a patriarchal god whose behavior cannot be quoted on family radio, but Cleopatra and Nefertiti and Jungian analysis, too, not to mention Freud's totems and taboos. A white-haired Carl Jung himself shows up personally in Switzerland for some boating and some art therapy with Tashi. An astonishing whimsy, considering the nature of her secret wound, her nightmare visions of the tower and the termites and the rooster, the traumatic memory of a murdered sister. We spend time as well in Paris and in America, an America that Tashi, somewhat to her own surprise, finds that she loves. There is a good black man, poor Adam, and a good white woman, Lisette, who is French, and several points of view, all of them compelling. But mostly, there's a madness that will end in death. When we first meet Tashi, she's on trial in Africa for murder. I won't tell you who she is supposed to have killed, nor whether she really did it. But she's blameless, like the vulva, although almost nobody else is. Alice Walker has taken as an epigraph for this cry of rage what she calls a bumper sticker. And what it says is this. When the axe came into the forest, the trees said, "The handle is one of us."
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Possessing the Secret of Joy by Alice Walker. She'll join us for an interview next week on Fresh Air. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tui, with Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A new print of Apocalypse Now has just come out on home video. A documentary about the making of the film will be out on home video next week. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Eleanor Coppola about shooting documentary footage behind the scenes of her husband's film. And actor Larry Fishburne tells us why he thought performing in the film would kill him. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.